This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know that feeling when you have something that's really been bothering you, or when you've been fixating on something in your life that's looming large in your mind? We all carry around different stressors in our lives, big and small, and I think we inherently know that when we keep them bottled up inside, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, and to figure out how to work through whatever it is that's weighing you down. Therapy isn't just for people who have experienced major trauma. There are plenty of benefits it can have for everyone. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. And don't underestimate the power of boundaries either. Those are super important. If you've been wondering if you should give therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's a fully online experience and designed from the ground up to be convenient and customizable to your schedule. To get started, you just have to fill out a brief questionnaire that will match you up with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no extra charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/filmdaily today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/filmdaily.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. On today's episode, we're going to discuss what we've been up to at the water cooler. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Serretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film Managing Editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Weekend Editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Senior Writer Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's going on?
And Writers Ytran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
And Chris Evangelista.
Hi.
Okay. Something new from you, Chris. Just a hi.
Was it? I don't know. That's all I have. That's all I have to give you today. The hi.
How have things been going, Chris?
Boy, I feel really on the spot right now.
I don't know.
things are fine, I guess. Let's get on with the show, shall we? Okay. And not talk about Chris.
You're like, take the spotlight off me right
yes,
now.
Please, quick. Please. Okay. Let me hide in my corner where I belong.
Okay. let's move into what we've been doing. This past week, for me, it's been filled with theme parks, and that's why I haven't been on the show much. I went to the grand reopening of Disneyland. It was closed for, I think, 412 days. Unprecedented. I think the nearest it had been closed before that was like 1 or 2 days or something insane. But, you know, for obvious reasons of why it was closed. And they have just reopened. And I was there on this historic reopening day, filming a video for Ordinary Adventures and also, you know, just enjoying it myself. And I'll say it was really emotional going back in there. When we stepped through the gates, the entire Main Street was just lined with cast members from all, you know, not just Main Street, from all over the park, just welcoming guests back. And like, I don't know, it's just cool to see all these people that, you know, had their jobs for the last year, you know, back. And they're, I don't know, they really seemed happy to be there. And Disneyland is operating at 25% capacity, which to me is still sounded like it was going to be a lot of people, but every ride was like 5 to 10 minute wait. Some were walk-ons. Like, it felt like there was parts of the park that you could look in an area and there was nobody within sight. It was, it really felt like Disneyland from 10, 15 years ago. If you went to like Disneyland on a weekday, and it, I don't know, it was strangely felt once it got back in there, it strangely felt like it hadn't been a year. That like it was, you know, like hanging out with an old friend, and it really felt like I was just there yesterday. Anyways, we have this whole video. I'm not gonna bog this podcast down with all the theme park stuff. But I'll link it in the show notes if you want to see that. And yeah, it was an emotional and fun day. And it's interesting to see how Disney is adapting, because they're doing things different than they're doing over in Disney World, how they're doing character interactions and stuff. And it's, I don't know, I think they're going to keep some of these things. Like, they have some of the characters just hanging out in their world. Like, normally at Disneyland, you would have to go, if you wanted to, say, meet Mickey Mouse, you'd have to go to Mickey Mouse's meet and greet spot, which is his his house in Toontown, and you'd have to wait in this long queue that goes through his house for like an hour to go meet Mickey, and then you'd get like 5 seconds with him. Now, you know, you could just see Mickey like in the front yard of his house, and he's like, watering the plants or something, and then you can have more of a extended interaction with the characters. Go check out the video and yeah, see that. And the other thing I did as I went back to Disneyland for May the 4th, this was yesterday. For those of you who don't know, May the 4th is the official Star Wars holiday. And I spent the day with Kitra in Batuu, which I'm not sure if you guys know this, but Galaxy's Edge opened about 2 years ago. But this is the first time that people on either coast were able to spend Star Wars Day in Galaxy's Edge. So it's kind of interesting because, you know, both of the parks were shut down on last May 4th, and they've released a new Legacy lightsaber. They released this Skywalker Legacy lightsaber limited edition set, which came with the two lightsabers from the end of Rise of Skywalker, and they were kind of wrapped in the way that Rey wraps them. So, and it came in this box that's kind of reminiscent of the box that I guess Maz Kanata, where she finds one of the sabers. But the new one is the Leia like lightsaber, which is just really cool. And I never realized until I got to see it in person, because it only is in the movie, you know, for mere seconds, and you only see it on screen like in close up for like probably a few frames. But it's interesting that how they chose to design that saber, because the top of the saber is very reminiscent of Luke's saber. It has that kind of Return of the Jedi Luke top. And then the bottom is very reminiscent of Ben Solo's saber. So it's kind of a combination of her brother and her son. And I don't know. It's a very cool saber. We also made a video about that and spending the whole day in Batuu, and there's a bunch of new merchandise and such. So go check that out. I'll put that in the show notes. Brad, what have you been up to?
Well, today I started doing a morning radio show. My friend Ben founded a charity organization, which I think I've talked about on the show before, here in town, that benefits a lot of local organizations and departments and just programs that deserve, you know, extra money to help them along. And occasionally he's appeared on this local radio station to promote certain events that we've been putting on and things like that. And he was offered the opportunity to do a morning radio show every other Wednesday. And since he and I have our own podcast together and we just have like a history of doing stuff like this kind of as a duo, he asked me if I wanted to co-host it with him. And so worked it out with you guys to leave for a little bit on every other Wednesday morning. And today we had our first episode. The show is called Ben, Brad, and Beyond. And it's basically just a morning talk radio show that's on at 9 a.m. Central. There'll be a link in the show notes of where you can watch like the first Facebook live stream for the episode today. And then you'll also be able to see like what... where you can listen to it otherwise. And so it's just basically a talk morning show where we just like address a variety of different pop culture subjects, from movies and TV to, you know, other things that like we talk about on the water cooler from time to time, like snacks, maybe music, technology, all that kind of stuff. And just very conversational, very off the cuff and loose. And it was just a good time. So it's just a little fun thing that we're doing, and we'll see where it goes from here.
Yeah, I'll put the link in the show notes if you want to go listen to Brad's new radio show. And let's move on to what we've been reading. And for once, it's rare that I'm reading anything. Not that I'm reading much. It's, you know, it's basically what I've been reading is one of those tabletop art books. And this is The Art of Star Wars Galaxy's Edge This was written by Amy Radcliffe, one of our friends. So, you know, disclaimer there. I'm also, as you know, a very big fanatic of not only Star Wars, but Star Wars Galaxy's Edge. So I was excited to get my hands on this because I love these art of books, and these usually show you how the development of a movie or thing evolved over from concept through the time to its execution. And it's all through the concept art, and Galaxy's Edge, as you know, went through many iterations, and it was cool to see a lot of the things that didn't make the cut, the ideas, the other rides. There was going to be like the speeder bike ride. They were going to have this bounty hunter chase ride, stores that didn't make the cut. There's a lot in there. I actually did a video about it on Ordinary Adventures that was posted on Slash Home. And I know Brad did a review of the book on Slash Home. We'll link those in the show notes. But I really like the book. If I have one criticism of the book, is I almost wish Amy got more interviews with the Imagineers and the artists, because at times there's just like cool things, like cool art of things, and then there's like one sentence on the bottom, and it doesn't really tell you like, oh, how did that evolve? Why did that get cut? Why did, you know, I wish there was like more information. And I'm guessing Imagineering probably nixed some stuff. I don't know that, but I'm just guessing. They're a very secretive organization. I'm guessing they didn't, you know, want some of the reasons of why stuff didn't make it or how it evolved, or, you know, there's ride systems that they're probably going to use for other rides, so maybe they don't want to talk about it. But Brad, you, like I said, you wrote a whole review. You wrote a whole review of this on the site. What did you think?
Yeah, the art in this book is incredible, as it is with all of these, you know, kinds of books, especially the Star Wars ones. And I had the same kind of frustration that you did, because there are some there's especially one big spread that's like 7 or 8 pages of this entire like nightclub scene that would have been like a bar and like a spice, what was it called?
Yeah, the Calicori Club. It's the Twi'lek Spice Den.
Yeah, Spice Den, yeah. And it was supposed to be like a sit-down restaurant experience. It seemed like a more of like an upper-class kind of dining experience. And there's tons of art in it. It looks amazing. And it just didn't happen. And they don't talk much about like the, you know, the logistics behind it, the decisions that were made not to. And that's the case with a lot of the stuff that they put in here that isn't part of the park. And I just wish that there was a little bit more of a dive into talking about, you know, why they made a decision not to do certain things. Because every now and then there's like a little bit of a hint of like one specific, you know, logistical thing that they thought, well, this probably won't work because of this reason and whatnot. But I wish that there was just a little bit more of a deep dive into that facet of the park. But of course, you know, Disney secrecy and whatnot. And, you know, I think some of the stuff too, it's like, some of it kind of speaks for itself as to why maybe it didn't happen. You know, and so some of it has to do with like,
I think you're probably talking about, there was this creature that you could board and travel throughout the land, and the creature would have to choose you to ride it because not many people would get a chance to ride it. And it just sounded like a logistical cluster of that would not work.
Yeah, because it was meant to be like interactive, and they probably only would have had like a handful of people that could have ridden it each day. You know, and the same thing with like that goes hand in hand with that. They had like a whole area with like a bunch of different creatures that people could like, you know, see almost like a small Star Wars zoo. And so yeah, it's a cool book to definitely see. And but it makes me hope and wish that some of these ideas, they will expand and continue to like beef up Galaxy's Edge, because it feels like it could be something even more epic than what it already is.
Yeah, I think that's another part of why they don't want to talk about some of this stuff, because some of the stuff I think will eventually make its way into there. Like we saw some of the entertainment, like these stunt shows that were kind of cut at the last minute. And I think we'll eventually see those. And some of, there's actually places in Galaxy's Edge that are empty. They're empty shells of buildings that could end up being some of these stores.
They also designed a bunch of like Blackspire Outpost and Batuu locals, like different alien species and stuff like that, and there aren't any of those walking around the park at all.
Yeah, that's kind of, that was my biggest disappointment when I first went there, was there was no real droids roaming and no aliens. Like, you could have had like one or two cast members dressed in as like a Twi'lek or something, make it feel in universe. But yeah, but I think even with all those criticisms, we both recommend checking this out
for sure.
Okay, let's move on to Jacob. Jacob, what have you been reading?
I'm reading Empire of Pain by Patrick Radden Keefe. This is a writer who wrote the book I talked about a few weeks ago called Say Nothing, about the troubles in Northern Ireland. And that was a book I raved about. This is his new book that just came out last month. And it's about the Sackler family, the billionaire family that essentially invented modern medical advertising and created OxyContin and started the opioid crisis, and how they've been one of America's most secretive billionaire families who are responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths and millions of addicts and refuse to take responsibility for it. And the book tracks their dynasty from, you know, when they were from the patriarch of the family, who was the son of immigrants, who has this kind of incredible life story. And you start realizing that just because you're a hard worker and you get a lot done doesn't make you a good person. And it goes from there. It's early for me yet. I still have a lot to go in the book. It's a brick-sized thing. But it's very much this infuriating but also engrossing epic tale of the American dream gone horribly wrong. And I've spoken about Keefe's, you know, work before with Say Nothing, but also his podcast, Wind of Change. I just think he's an incredible writer and an incredible journalist. And Empire of Pain feels like a really definitive book about a family who would much rather not be exposed to the spotlight, considering all the pain they've caused to people all over the world. So it's Empire of Pain. I really recommend it based on what I've read so far and based on the fact that I think Keefe is just one of the top tier writers and journalists alive today.
Jacob, I want to tell you real quick. On May 11th, HBO has a new Alex Gibney documentary called The Crime of the Century. And it's all about this. And they actually interview the writer you're talking about. And he guides you pretty much through the whole documentary. So you should check that out.
Oh man, I'm going to have to hold off on that. I want to finish the book first, but yeah, I feel like if you don't want to read a 550 page book about OxyContin and the opioid crisis and the scumbags who caused it, then yeah, look out for that doc. You say it's called Crime of the Century, Chris?
Yeah, it's two parts. It's like 4 hours long. I watched it over the weekend. There's the first part's 2 hours, the second part 2 hours. So May 11th on HBO Max.
Yeah, well, not fun material, but probably necessary material. So that's what I've been reading.
Okay, let's move on to HT. What have you been reading?
I've been reading Doctor Who, The Writer's Tale by Russell T. Davies. And Russell T. Davies is the showrunner for Doctor Who from 2005, when the revival took place, to 2010. And this book goes into his writing process as well over the length of him overseeing the final season and the last few David Tennant specials of the show. And it takes place over like a correspondence, an email correspondence between him and Benjamin Cook, who is a reporter / journalist for Doctor Who magazine. And it's a really great read, in addition to being just this really fun trove of fun facts and trivia behind the scenes of what was happening in that final season that he was on, which was season 4. It talks about his writer's process, and in a way that he just kind of bears it all and talks. It's mostly him talking about how he's met most of his deadlines and trying to figure out how to reconcile his creative sort of aspirations and ideas for the show and like such wild ideas that you get for Doctor Who with the limited budget that he gets from BBC, and trying to just sort of navigate that. And it's really fascinating. It's a really great read, regardless of whether you're a Doctor Who fan. Of course, it's a much more rewarding read if you're a Doctor Who fan, but it was a really interesting just sort of insight into the writer's process, especially a writer who is at the head of a show that at the time when he was running it was just like the biggest thing, one of the biggest things in the world at the time, and having to be the lead writer as well as, you know, be the executive producer and be on and have his hands on every part of the process. It's great. So that's The Writer's Tale. There's actually two versions of this. I'm reading the Writer's Tale, the final chapter, which is the original version, in addition to 300 extra pages of material from when he was corresponding during the final stretch of his time on Doctor Who and into the Matt Smith era. And it's so the whole thing is about like 700 pages, which is a hefty read, but I would recommend, yeah, for sure, reading like the final version, which was published in 2010.
HD, can I read this being where I am in Doctor Who right now? You know, I'm only in just finished season three with you as part of our podcast.
There are some spoilers, so I would recommend reading this once you get through season four.
Okay, fair enough. This has been sitting in my Amazon cart for like weeks now, to be honest.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun. It's just like Russell T. Davies is a very cheeky guy, so he makes a lot of jokes about people's butts, people's thighs, Stephen Moffat's thighs. So it's a lot of fun.
I love how while Brad and I are basically looking at picture books, Jacob and HT are trying to outdo themselves with like 700,000 page books of text.
It's a lot of text.
Yes. Okay, let's move on to what we've been watching. Ben, what have you been watching?
Jacob and I watched The Mitchells versus The Machines, which I think both Chris and Brad have spoken about before, so we probably won't go too long on this, but this is, I think, last time I checked, was the number one movie on Netflix over the past few days, and it's the animated movie that has Lord and Miller on as producers, and is directed by a guy named Mike Rianda. And I didn't love this movie as much as everybody seems to. I love the look of it for the most part. I think the animation is pretty fantastic, but there are, I feel like I'm sort of caught in this weird in-between age bracket with this movie, where it seems to, half the movie seems to be, well, okay, so let me back up for 1 second. The film, the central relationship in the film is between a father and daughter, and the father is like depicted as, you know, somebody who is completely incompetent when it comes to technology, and the daughter is somebody who grew up using her cell phone constantly and is an aspiring filmmaker and you know, is very much tapped into, you know, online culture and living her life through social media in what appears to be a healthy way in this movie. I feel like this film is sort of split in half, where half of the jokes are aimed at an audience that can relate to the old man who like is completely allergic to all things tech related. And then the other half where the movie just gets really manic and uses actual, you know, YouTube footage and does some really interesting things formally, but is just like overstimulation, you know, dialed up to 11. And that is supposed to be sort of more on the wavelength of this younger character, this daughter character. But I feel kind of like in between those two. Like, I was kind of annoyed at a lot of the you know, hyper stylization stuff that surrounded the filmmaking aspect of it. Like the character's aspiring filmmaking. She makes YouTube videos with her dog and, you know, does all these, there are constantly like little rainbows and like, you know, pieces of animation that, that are intended to sort of highlight certain emotions or certain sequences or whatever. And then those were fine, but the movie often tips into, you know, these like full page, it like pauses for a second to just crank the dial all the way up in terms of style. And I just found those to be more grating than endearing, which I think they're supposed to be for people of her age. And then the old guy, like, oh, I don't know what a computer is, I can't use any of this stuff. It just feels like it's, you know, 20 years old in terms of comedy. Like, what are we doing here? This person, you know, the age wise, to have a daughter this age, this guy, it just did not seem like, it seemed like a sitcom dad from like 1992 or something, instead of you know, somebody who's supposed to be the age that he is. So I sort of had a little bit of a pushback when it came to the film's humor. I think there are some really great jokes in here, and I love the general look of the movie when it's not like super over the top and stylized. I also kind of, you know, while I'm in the mood of dunking on this movie or whatever you want to call it, I just, a lot of the film centers around this idea that the Mitchell family is this super weird family and they're the only ones who are able to save the world from this robot apocalypse. And I'm just sitting there going like, your family is not that weird. It's like, my wife and I were talking about that this afterwards, and it kind of reminded me of like that conversation that everybody seemed to be having about 10 years ago, where like, just because you love Star Wars doesn't mean you're a nerd, you know, like that's it kind of had a little bit of that vibe to me, like, oh my God, where my little brother loves dinosaurs. Isn't he weird? And like, you're not really that's pretty typical, you know? So, you know, aside from those nitpicks, which I haven't really seen, there's been so much praise for this movie. So I just wanted to lend my voice to some of those things that I sort of had a problem with. So it just wouldn't be praise across the board here for this film. So just in case anybody watching it is like, I don't know about this, I'm a little mixed on this, I just wanted to have somebody out there who those people in the middle maybe didn't feel quite as alone. So Jacob, what did you think about this?
I think you're not wrong, because your opinion is valid, but this is my favorite movie of the year so far, and I can't imagine like anything topping it. This is like a pretty much a perfect movie that I want to watch constantly over and over again. I'm not going to say you're wrong, because that would be mean. I'm not a mean person, but I pretty much disagree with everything Ben just said. I think this movie is an absolute delight. I think it's impeccably structured. I think it walks about 1,000 different tightropes and does so with so much wit, grace, and like heart. I love how the script is setting up jokes within jokes that pay off both dramatically and in a humorous context. I love how there's not a wasted moment, how I paused it 30 minutes in to get a glass of water, and I realized, oh, wow, like an entire movie's worth of stuff has already happened in 30 minutes. And it just is like Spider-Verse before, you know, which shares producers and Lord Miller. It was just this economy of storytelling, of being able to squeeze so much characterization and plot into limited amount of space without making it feel overstuffed. I love how it looks. I love how it looks like a 3D watercolor with enhanced lines and etchings. And I like how the hand-drawn animation comes in to reflect the main character, the teenage daughter's personality. I like how these Lord Miller productions make style part of the substance. I mean, I love Pixar, but Pixar's whole thing is hiding its style a lot of time, putting storytelling first. That's Disney does that too. It's all about the animation just being there to serve these characters in the story, which is great. But Lord Miller's productions and the filmmakers they work with are very much about, yes, but we can do things with this medium that you can't do in live action. Let's make sure you see the animation. Let's do things that can only be done with this medium. And you saw it in Spider-Verse, you saw it in the Lego movie, you saw it in Clive Chance Meatballs, and you see it so much here. The visual imagination here is absolutely incredible. I think, and also I'll just talk about a thing that mattered to me, which is after years of Disney and Pixar queer baiting people saying this character may be gay, there's this movie where it's made clear in the actual text that the teenage daughter character is gay, and the fact that her entire worldview at first seems like you know, possibly subtext, like, and you feel like this relationship between her and her father feels like, is she just weird and him is old-fashioned? You start to realize that, no, this is a movie about a really well-meaning but old-fashioned guy who desperately wants to connect with his gay daughter and does all that in the story of a robot apocalypse. And I think that's really powerful and meaningful. And the fact that it's clear immediately to anybody who's queer, and then the film goes out its way at the end to make sure this wasn't subtext, this is the actual text. It does what every other animation studio has claimed they want to do and haven't, and they make it look easy. And so the ball's in your court now, Disney, because Lord and Miller have built a machine that is more visually interesting, funnier, and more upfront and honest about representing what people actually are these days than you have been in a while. So let's see how other people react to this. I think Mitchell's versus the machines is as close to perfect as Spider-Verse was. So I'll be talking about this movie for a long time and revisiting it very often.
Jacob, there's one joke. Do you think it's appropriate for me to ruin one like relatively small joke in this movie, considering that it just came out this past Friday, or should I just let this go and maybe we'll talk about it some other time?
The movie has 10,000 jokes, so I think you'll be okay.
Okay, so there's one scene real quick that sort of encapsulates my like roller coaster relationship with this movie. And the villain at one point turns off the world's Wi-Fi, the Wi-Fi for the entire planet. And everybody around the world just completely loses their minds in really over the top ways. And it cuts to all these different countries and locations, and everybody's reacting the same way, just like completely freaking out in ways that really sort of made me roll my eyes, because it felt like oversimplified and just really outdated. Like, again, like very 90s and just like completely out of touch with the modern style of humor that goes throughout the rest of this movie. But there's a really great joke in that scene where this guy crashes through a window onto a table in a restaurant, and he's holding a box, and he says something like, "Hey lady, can you unbox this in front of me?" Just like the idea that the Wi-Fi has taken away the thing that he loves most in the world, which is just watching unboxing videos on YouTube. And he is just desperate for anybody to perform that service in front of him as a way to like keep himself going. I just found to be a really kind of smart and just really, really funny moment within a scene that made me roll my eyes a lot. I feel like that happened many times over the course of this movie. So I just wanted to lay that out there. And that's sort of my, that's where I fall a little bit on this movie. It's kind of like, I liked it for the most part, but there were several things that sort of held it back from being like a full-blown masterpiece for me.
I see where you're coming from. And for me, it's a case of this movie having jokes within jokes within jokes, broad jokes, subtle jokes, character jokes, you know, jokes that are, you know, if you don't like this style of humor, don't worry, there's another joke from a different style of humor coming in 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I can understand why maybe that collision didn't work for you. For me, for a movie who has a lot of points to make in the end, I think about, you know, family and relationships and relationship technology. But I think this scene really encapsulates how this is a movie about technology and maybe our over-reliance on it, that also understands how much fun technology is and understands why we love it. So I think that scene, why it rubbed you the wrong way, those two different jokes represent how you can be of two minds of things. Like, you love the internet and you hate it. And that's how I read from the film's, you know, collision of styles and ideas. It bothered mm-hmm. you, but to me, it felt very much like a very clear message about how they're not here to judge you for liking, you know, for liking YouTube videos, even though we can acknowledge it. But sometimes, yes, it's annoying. Get your head stuck in your phone watching YouTube for hours on end.
Yeah, fair enough.
Ben, I hate to put you on the spot because you were so critical of this, and I know you said you enjoyed it all the same. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, like, if you were going to give this film a 1 out of 10 rating, just because I want people to get the feel of like where you would actually like rank, you know, how your temperature is of the film, because it's very hard to gauge.
Yeah, no, I certainly, that's a fair point. Cause I think I was bringing up mostly my complaints here, and I think I would give it like a, I don't know, like a 7.5 out of 10 or something like that. I liked it quite a bit. I just think that there are several things that didn't fully connect with me, like on a thematic level. And then also, you know, those plots things that sort of held it back a little bit for me.
Yeah. And I also want to respond to Jacob's criticism of Disney not going full blown with the whole gay character thing. I do want to bring up, I think you are right, Jacob, for the most part, but Pixar did come out with this film in 2020 called Out. It was a short. It was part of their Spark Shorts program, but it was by this director, Stephen Hunter, and it's very personal, very heartfelt. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but
it's wonderful. You're correct, Peter. I should have mentioned Out, but when Pixar does this with a lead character in a main theatrical release or Disney Plus release feature film, we can have this conversation. But Out is absolutely wonderful. That's streaming on Disney Plus right now.
And I don't want to be like, you know, shorts aren't as important as movies, because obviously they, you know, all art is art. But I agree with you. They need to do it on the big stage.
I mean, really, I feel like Lord and Miller right now is the animation that they facilitate, that they put their names on, is as exciting as Pixar was when Pixar was new and exciting. So I really hope this ends up benefiting everybody. I would love, like, this last year we saw Pixar make Soul, which I really love, but also Onward, which is just okay. I would love it if seeing Mitchells versus the Machines lit a fire under Pixar so that all the movies were as good as Soul and they didn't like release Onwards every year or so.
Fair enough. Okay, I gotta see this movie this week. I'm definitely gonna make that happen. But what I have been watching is I watched The Bad Batch on Disney Plus. This came out yesterday on May the 4th, and this is the animated series set in the Star Wars universe. It's kind of a spin-off of Star Wars The Clone Wars, which I know everybody seems to love. I like it a lot, but I wasn't like, you know, I like Rebels more than Clone Wars. There's just so many like I know this is like a controversial word, but there's so many filler episodes of Clone Wars that I feel like, you know, when Clone Wars is at its best, it's amazing, but there's so much not great. But of the last season of Clone Wars, which was amazing, the episodes that I wasn't really as into focused on this group of clone troopers called the Bad Batch, and Disney decided to spin them off into their own series. And I gotta admit, I was not excited to watch the show. I actually didn't even plan on watching it. I was not, like, as a Star Wars fanatic, that is saying something. I really just had very little interest, but I got sent the screener early and we ran out of like some interesting stuff. And I was like, you know, let's put this on. Let's see what this is. And it's really surprising where this first episode goes, where it brings us in the Star Wars timeline, what characters appear, what kind of twists and turns it takes. I'm not saying that this whole show is going to be great. I know Dave Filoni is not as involved as he was, obviously, with the Clone Wars. So I am a little skeptical of if it can keep up to what it was in this first pilot episode. It's like a two episodes, like a double episode. But I would encourage you, if this is something that you totally were not excited about, give that first episode a try, because I think it has the potential to be something good. But I think I mentioned a few weeks back that I watched the first couple episodes of Mighty Ducks Game Changers. Actually, I think I only watched the first episode, and Brad had watched many more at the time. And I have since caught up to, I think, I didn't see the most recent, but I saw everything before that, whatever that is, like 6 episodes or 7 episodes. And I will say that the first couple episodes have potential, but like don't quite like reach the level of the Mighty Ducks movies. I do think that this show does pick up. I'm invested now. 3 episodes in, there's a real turning point, and I feel like I actually care about this team. The show really captures the urge to want to root for the underdogs, and you know, 2/3 of the way through the season, it's been promoted, you know, all over by Disney, but the original Mighty Ducks make an appearance on this, and which was a fun reunion. Brad, have you caught up with this show, Mighty Ducks Game Changers? Are you feeling any better about it? Because I know you were like very on the line of not sure if you liked it or not.
I wouldn't say that I was on the line. I had some complaints about it, but I thought that it was decent and it had potential to grow into something. And I think that because I saw the first 3 episodes for that review, and then I think that, like you just said, it really starts to come into its own with episodes 4 through 6, leading up to episode 6 being when the original Mighty Ducks come back for a reunion. And I think that it's really starting to feel more like a Mighty Ducks movie that's been stretched out into a series rather than something that felt a little closer to Disney Channel, although not quite as hokey or cheesy. Because what I appreciate about the last weekend's episode that had the reunion is that it really put some drama into it. It wasn't just this normal happy-go-lucky reunion of like, oh, let's all reminisce and everything. You know, there was an arc for Gordon Bombay, and there was some tension between him and the team, and there's a tease as to something not being quite right between Bombay and Charlie Conway, Joshua Jackson's character from the original franchise. I'm really liking where this series is going. I actually have screeners for the next 4 episodes through the end of the first season that I haven't gotten around to watching yet. So I'm sure I'll talk about those, you know, once I'm allowed to in the near future. But I'm really enjoying this. And on a slash film note, I interviewed the 6 original Mighty Ducks who appear in the reunion episode, and also original franchise writer Stephen Brill, who directed that episode and also is a writer on the show. So be sure to check those out.
Yeah, it is kind of funny that when they appear, they look almost nothing like what they did as kids. I mean, as most adults do. So they kind of had to have like photos of them on the wall to be like, look, that's me. So
I totally disagree. I feel like they look exactly like they did as kids. Yeah.
I don't know, but okay. Maybe I haven't seen Mighty Ducks in the longest time, but there was one last thing I wanted to talk about, And this is a movie that's on Amazon Prime. I think it's an original there, or it's exclusive to there. It's called The Map of Tiny Perfect Things. I don't think anybody on here has talked about this film. Has anybody seen this? Sounds like no. Okay. That is, I've been greeted by the silence of nobody seeing this. This movie was recommended to me by quite a few people. And I got to admit, it's gone by the wayside. I have not seen anybody talking about this movie. I think I did a search on Slash Film, and I think we covered a trailer or something. It's really like we did.
Is that movie with Lily Reinhart? Am I getting it wrong? It's like a weepy of some kind.
A weepy? What does weepy mean?
A Walk to Remember kind of sad
romance. It is a coming of age movie, but I don't. Who's Lily Reinhart? I don't know.
Okay, I'm just mistaking it for something else. Never mind.
Oh. Is it the time travel one, Peter?
Yeah,
the time loop
movie. Yes.
Oh. Okay.
It's like Teen Palm Springs.
Yes. Okay, so this movie feels to me like something I would see at Sundance and fall in love with. It's like a coming-of-age time loop movie, and it stars these two people, Kyle Allen, who I think is in the upcoming West Side Story and maybe American Horror Story or something, and Catherine Newton, who, what is she in? She's been in...
Freaky and Blockers.
Big Little Lies, Pokemon, or Detective Pikachu. Yeah. Okay, so she's in a bunch of stuff. And the pitch of this is it's a time loop movie, and we've seen time loop movies. It's basically Palm Springs. Okay. But I will say, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why this hasn't gotten any play is this is kind of the same thing where it's not just one person, but two people stuck in the same time loop in the same place, reliving the same day over and over again, which is very Palm Springs. And Palm Springs is a better movie on every level. So I'm not going to say that this is better than Palm Springs. And I think many people would probably see this movie and be like, oh, this is a copy of Palm Springs, even though this was written as a short story in 2016 by this guy named Lev Grossman, who is I haven't followed his work, but he's the author behind the very successful The Magicians, which was turned into a sci-fi TV series. Anyways, the pitch behind this, I think, is that you have two teenagers stuck in this world, the small town world, reliving this one day over and over again. And as the movie begins, they've already reached God level. They're already Bill Murray at the end of Groundhog Day, where they know everything that's going to happen and are able to use that to their advantage or disadvantage. And the opening has like this really fun one take, or is presented as one take. I'm not sure if it's actually shot as one take, where the lead character like knows everything that's going to happen throughout this town square and is like dodging and weaving and doing all the stuff. I don't know, it's a lot of fun. I was going to recommend it to HT because it has a couple of Doctor Who references, which I didn't understand because.
Oh, okay. Maybe I will watch it then.
It references Time Bandits. It actually also references Groundhog Day and Edge of Tomorrow. So it's a world where time loop movies already exist. I had fun. It is a little like formulaic, and you know where it's gonna go and stuff like that, but it does have some interesting twists as well. But I feel like this is a movie that's not on many people's radar, and everybody probably has Amazon Prime, or most people do. I would say check it out. It's called the Map of Tiny Perfect Things, and you can see it there. Okay, Brad, what have you been watching?
I took the time to watch Without Remorse, which is the new Michael B. Jordan movie that's based on Tom Clancy's novel of the same name. It is on Amazon Prime. It was a Paramount Pictures movie, but then Amazon picked it up from them. And it's just kind of there. It's very bland. I mean, it's not as if Tom Clancy is the most exciting writer to begin with, but, you know, Clear and Present Danger and Patriot Games are solid, as is The Hunt for Red October. But, you know, like, Sum of All Fears is not great, and Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit is one of the most boring things I've ever seen in my entire life. And while the action in this movie is very technically impressive, and they do some pretty cool things with long single take sequences and moments, and Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Bell are both good in their roles, the movie itself just feels like it's following a formula. It's very bland and predictable, and there aren't any like peaks where things rise in excitement or thrills or anything like that. It's just pretty much on cruise control the entire way through, just coasting. There's nothing unexpected here whatsoever, nothing surprising. And I just, yeah, it feels like it's trying to emulate certain kinds of action movies from the 90s, but not in a way that feels like it has any real style or substance to it. So I walked away just feeling disappointed, like I ate a piece of styrofoam. There's just like no flavor or anything like that. So bit of a bummer. I hope that they figure out a way to give Michael B. Jordan something better to do as a leading man. And obviously Creed is a good showcase for him, and I'm glad that he's going to be directing the third one. But when it comes to movies like this, I just hope that someone can give him something better to do in the future, because this unfortunately isn't it. I also watched a new horror movie on Netflix called Things Heard and Seen. It stars Amanda Seyfried, and this one also was supremely disappointing. Another thing where it just feels like it's a paint-by-numbers horror movie where a family who's having some issues moves to a new house in the countryside, and they each have like problems with each other, and then they each have secrets that they keep from each other, and then there's these spirits in the house, but the spirits don't really end up having much of an impact on what happens with the story, and it just doesn't take any compelling turns or have any truly scary moments. And the ending is absolutely baffling and terrible and just doesn't make any sense. It just feels like it just sputters out. And I was just very upset that I wasted my time for something that I hoped would offer a little bit of terror, but it just was boring and bland. And continuing my streak of things that were relatively disappointing, I watched Mortal Kombat on HBO Max. And the action and fight sequences in this movie are very well done, spectacular even. It's nice to see that they, you know, had a real budget for this movie, that they really put some effort into making the sequences actually feel like they had, you know, much more legitimate martial arts and fighting styles. But I found myself frustrated by something, you know, this is something that Chris has talked about before, is that it's a movie that is very clearly trying to set up an entire franchise and doing all this heavy lifting and promising things that are coming in the future without thinking about how to make this movie good on its own. You know, I on one level, I like what it does with the Mortal Kombat mythos. I don't mind that it kind of steers away from some of the elements of the video games, because as you know, rich as the mythology of the video game franchise has become since the first game, it's not something that I particularly care about. And I think that it's kind of hard to dig into that much detail without doing like a full blown big budget TV series. But I also just like, it felt like they were trying to do too much to make characters matter when the big focus, you know, of something like this is like, let's have them fight and there's a fight tournament, which we don't even get to in this movie. And so it was one of those things where I just like, I like what they went for, but I feel like the end product didn't exactly land as firmly as I hoped. So I wasn't bored in the movie, but after just watching and thinking about, you know, what it tried to do, I just feel like it didn't quite measure up to those hopes. So fun action, but whatever, as you know, a whole movie.
So it sounds like you were 3 for 3.
Yeah, I struck out, so I'm not watching movies ever again.
I mean, that's the right takeaway there, right? Chris, what have you been watching?
I just watched In the Heights, which is, of course, the new John M. Chu movie based on the Lin-Manuel Miranda Broadway musical. And it was good. It was good, not great.
Wait, I have a question before you start. Like, had you seen the musical? Or
no, I've heard the music. I've listened to the soundtrack, but I actually haven't seen this one performed live. So, you know, the social reaction has lifted. So let's count that as this. The review embargo is still going on. And when the social embargo lifts, everyone was really super, super positive. And I was like, oh, man, this is going to be great. And I didn't love it. I mean, the songs are great and the cast is phenomenal across the board. Everyone is doing really good work here. I think the problem I had with it is John M. Chu, even though he does some really cool inventive stuff, like there's a dance sequence that's like on the side of a building and that's really neat, a lot of the musical numbers are shot in this sort of like medium close-up where you just see people like walking down a street, and it's just kind of like boring. Like I just feel like if you're gonna make a musical like this, go all out, make it sort of like, you know, just, I should be able to see more than people from the waist up walking down a street. I don't know. And another problem I had with it is it's just too long. It's like 144 minutes. And, you know, Hamilton is long too, but Hamilton, the difference is Hamilton is a completely sung through musical where there's no dialogue. It's just all music from beginning to end. And In the Heights isn't like that. There's actually a lot of dialogue in this. And every time the movie stops a musical number to have dialogue, the movie just drags. I was like, man, I just wish they would get back to singing because I really like these songs. But beyond that, you know, it's an entertaining movie. It's, you know, I didn't hate it. I wasn't like, oh, what a waste of time. But I was, I don't know. The very strong hype that came from that social media reaction a few weeks ago really set me up for something better than this was. But beyond that, I feel like people will like the movie in general just because it's a very upbeat, you know, positive. I don't, you know, there's dramatic things in it, so I don't want to call it like a happy-go-lucky movie, but I do think it's like a sort of a feel-good sort of film. So people will enjoy it, but I don't know. I wanted something a little bit more than what I got.
Well, that's disappointing.
Yeah. On the other side of the coin, I finally watched The Father, which is, of course, the Anthony Hopkins movie that made a lot of headlines at the Oscars, kind of all for all the wrong reasons, because everyone was assuming Chadwick Boseman was going to win Best Actor, and then Anthony Hopkins won, and it sort of left a bad taste in everyone's mouth. And I am fucking kicking myself for not watching this sooner, because if I had watched it last year, or, you know, at the end of last year, this absolutely would have been in my top 10 movies of the year. This movie is phenomenal. It's just emotional and incredibly well edited. The whole movie, it's about Anthony Hopkins' character. He has Alzheimer's, but the entire movie is done from his point of view. And as a result, like everything he keeps experiencing, and by extension, everything we keep experiencing, keeps changing. And you can't really get a hold on what's really happening when it's happening. And the way they edit this all together is incredible. It's almost like a horror movie, because you know, you're constantly on edge because you know the main character doesn't really understand what's going on, and you just keep waiting for the next confusing or unexplained thing to happen and throw, you know, the balance of the movie off. And the work Anthony Hopkins does here is phenomenal. I completely understand why they gave him that Oscar. You know, Chadwick Boseman was great too in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, but the stuff Anthony Hopkins is doing here is like some of the best acting I've ever seen from him. And, you know, that's saying a lot because he's a great actor in general, but this is like one of the best performances of his career. So I can't recommend The Father enough. I know a lot of people just sort of avoided it in general because it just seemed like, you know, generic Oscar bait movie, and it's really not. It's so much better than that. So I really encourage you to to seek this out. And then finally, I started watching Warrior, which is used to be a Cinemax show or Max Go, but they moved it to HBO Max. And I had been hearing people talk about this. And after, you know, the disappointment of Mortal Kombat, I was like, man, I want to watch something with fights that's good. And that is this show. You know, there are a lot of shows now in our peak TV era where people are like, you got to stick with it. You know, watch the first three or four episodes, then it gets good. And this is the opposite of that, because this is good, like, from the get-go. It's just really well-made, and the fights are fucking incredible, and the action is great. Plot-wise, it's not, like, the most original thing in the world, but that doesn't matter. It's kind of like Deadwood meets Peaky Blinders, but with martial arts. So if that sounds like something you want to watch, I really recommend this. This is... it just kicks ass. The first two seasons are now on HBO Max, and there's a third season that's coming soon eventually. So if you're looking for, you know, really cool fight scenes, please watch Warrior, because it delivers.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of people say that this is a good show, but just no one was watching it because it was only available on what, like Cinemax or something?
Yeah. They just recently moved it to HBO Max. And so it's definitely worth checking out.
Okay. Jacob, what have you been watching?
I've been watching Mystery Men, or rather, I watched Mystery Men, the 1999 superhero comedy parody. I haven't seen it in a little while, and it's a very strange film to revisit because it is simultaneously a film of its time, but also a film about 20 years too early, because it is this combination of everybody who was, you know, hot in the late 90s in one movie. It's like Ben Stiller right before he was, you know, about to become really huge. It's Janine Garofalo back when she was extremely relevant. William H. Macy back when he was in his post-Fargo lap of, like, starring in a lot of movies. Greg Kinnear back before Greg Kinnear was shuttled off to direct-to-video faith-based movies. It's all these huge names in this extremely expensive-looking superhero comedy. And I mean, even Smash Mouth's All Stars, the theme song, which immediately pegs it to 1999. And there's stuff in this movie that's really interesting. It has a really ahead of its time look at superheroes, in that there's the character played by Greg Kinnear, who's a sort of Superman, Batman figure, who is very much a Homelander from The Boys before The Boys was a TV show. And it has this sort of winking evisceration of the entire superhero genre before that was so omnipresent, back when it was, you know, only a handful of movies instead of something that was regularly happening. But it's also frequently really bad. I mean, Paul Rubens' character, who's a superhero whose powers, he farts really effectively, is one of the unfunniest things I've ever seen committed to in a big screen comedy like this. But there also are things I think are genius, like William H. Macy's character, whose superpowers, he's good at wielding a shovel, which is inherently funny to me. It is just this... If you read about the production of it, apparently the cast did not get along. They were constantly fighting over the tone of the movie. Nobody could agree on what the film should feel like. You can really see the chaos in the film. And the chaos sometimes works and sometimes really doesn't. It's a film that's so clever, but also very clever without being funny. And very expensive while also looking cheap. And I feel like there's another version of this film that came out in 2020 instead of 1999. And it would have been a big deal. People would have gotten the joke a lot more than they got in 1999, where the film was a huge bomb. So a film that is far from perfect, frequently bad, but also I think had its eye on the prize, its eye on the ball, more so than a lot of other movies made today do. I'm just curious about the crew here. Where do we all fall on Mystery Men these days?
I remember not liking it, but I agree with you. If James Gunn made it today, it would be awesome.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's the right filmmaker with this tone. I think, I think you're right. I think James Gunn with these characters would have knocked out the park. Ben, you've seen Mystery Men, Ben.
I saw it in theaters when I was about 14, and I hated it at the time because I didn't understand it. But listening to you talk about it now makes me feel like I kind of want to rewatch it just so I can, like, fully understand what it is. But I'm fighting against my own memories of it being, like, not quite as funny as I wanted, even you know, even taking the satire element away, like, I don't remember the comedy being great. And the fact that it came out, what, 21 years ago now means that I don't know if it's going to hold up comedically super well. So
it doesn't.
Like,
it doesn't.
Yeah, so I won't be able to enjoy it on that level. So it would basically just be an intellectual exercise for me to revisit it at this point. And I don't know if I'm willing to do that, but I'm glad that you had the experience that you did.
Yeah, I mean, it's... If you watched this in 1999, or you skipped 99, but you remember it, it is such a time capsule. It is a superhero parody that's looking at the entire genre, but is very much stylized around, you know, Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher. And I just feel like its ambitions are so much bigger than what the genre could have given it at the time. And if they could just edit out Paul Rubens' character, I feel like the movie gets better already. Okay, that's enough of Mystery Men. Unless anybody else has any scintillating thoughts on Mystery Men, a movie out of, like Unbreakable, I think arrived about 15, 20 years too early for people to really appreciate it. But Unbreakable is a much better movie, like in every possible way. So I'll leave that there. Speaking of things from 1999, I started rewatching Sopranos. My wife hasn't seen it. And, you know, I guess a hot take, Sopranos is a great show. It's funny because the pilot episode, which was produced a year before the rest of the season was picked up and filmed, it feels a little off. If you've seen all Sopranos, the pilot is like, oh, was this how the show always felt? And you watch episode two, and it's like, oh yeah, that's the show. But, you know, it's all streaming on HBO Max these days, and Sopranos, I feel like, this has been buried. People have not forgotten the Sopranos, but this is the show that kicked off, you know, the golden age of TV. All of our modern shows would not exist without Sopranos, and it's remarkable that a show that is a foundational piece of pop culture history has held up as well as it has. I mean, the modern discourse may not be kind to it because it's a show that asks you to really empathize with genuinely terrible people. And I've always liked shows that challenge me in that way. And I think The Sopranos is one of the greatest TV shows ever made. And I'm happy to be revisiting and remembering why. It's great. It's like, if you've been putting off just because it's, you know, 20 years old and you feel like you're just other shows to watch in the age of peak TV, stop it, because Sopranos is still more than worth your time.
Okay, and let's move on to Ben. Ben, what have you been watching?
Well, my wife and I finished watching, we're completely caught up now with Curb Your Enthusiasm. And after we finished the show, I realized that this whole show started from an HBO special that came out in 1999. Wow, continuing the 1999 trend that Jacob just laid down there. So yeah, it's basically just a long episode of the show. I think it's like an hour long or something. And the show is only 30 minutes, if I remember right. And it's like the quality difference, you know, going from something that was filmed in, I think 2017 was the most recent season. Last year, sorry, was the most recent season of the show. So going from something that was filmed in 2020 to something that was filmed in 1999, just the digital camera technology, like the quality of the thing is just so terrible. Like it looks like trash. But the humor and the foundations for what the show would become are very, very evident in this special. So it's sort of just, yeah, I was talking about like an intellectual exercise earlier. It's just sort of a fascinating thing to like go back and watch the show and think about it as a launch pad for what would become Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I think is like one of the funniest and certainly most long running American comedies maybe ever. So it is very, very, I'm not going to say that it's like as great as like some of my favorite episodes of the show, but it's a really interesting thing to watch if you're a fan of Curb and you've never watched the original special that's streaming on HBO Max right now. And then the only other thing that I've been watching that I wanted to mention here is a 1954 movie called Brigadoon. Has anybody else here seen this movie by any chance? Nobody. Okay. So this film was directed by Vincent Minnelli, and it stars Gene Kelly and Sid Charisse and Van Johnson. And I'll read you the IMDb description here. Two Americans on a hunting trip in Scotland become lost. They encounter a small village, not on the map, called Brigadoon, in which people harbor a mysterious secret and behave as if they were still living 200 years in the past. So it is a CinemaScope, huge, brightly colored movie. I think I want to say MGM was the studio that released this, and it is just, you know, lush colors and ridiculous dance numbers and like everything that you could want from, you know, a big musical of this time period. I enjoyed it a lot. The premise is like a little silly. It's like these two, like I just read, like these two guys basically stumble upon this village that, I guess the IMDb seems to be shielding the actual premise a little bit, but the gist is they stumble onto this village that only appears every 100 years. And I have a lot of questions about the logistics of exactly how that works and how these townspeople operate and all of that stuff. But, you know, putting the nitpicking aside, it's a really, really fun movie. And I really recently just found out that there's a show on Apple TV Plus, or it's coming to Apple TV Plus very soon, called Schmigadoon, which I guess is like a riff on this show that stars Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key, and they play a couple who stumbles onto a town where everybody acts like it's a 1940s musical all the time. So having seen this movie and being certain that there are going to be, you know, overt references to it, I feel like Schmigadoon is going to be a lot of fun. So maybe consider it a little homework if that show sounds like fun to you. So yeah, Brigadoon is not streaming anywhere right now, but you can rent it from, you know, Amazon and YouTube and all the different places for like $3 if you want to check it out.
Okay. HT, what have you been watching?
I watched I Saw the Devil, which is the South Korean thriller film by Kim Ji-woon, directed by Kim Ji-woon. He's the director of A Tale of Two Sisters. And I think Jacob had recommended me this after I watched A Tale of Two Sisters and was very struck and terrified by that movie. And I Saw the Devil is stars Lee Byung-hun and Choi Min-sik. Choi Min-sik is of Old Boy fame, as in this sort of serial killer film in which Lee Byung-hun is a special agent whose fiance is brutally murdered by Choi Min-sik's serial killer. And it's brutal. It's a very brutal and unflinching and violent movie. While I was watching this, it just made me wonder how many serial killers are living in this one area of South Korea that is just kind of like this rural area outside of Seoul, because at least 5 serial killers pop up in this movie. And I found it a little ridiculous at one point. But yeah, the gore and the violence in this are definitely shocking. I just didn't find it, but I didn't find it as emotionally interesting as some other like Korean revenge films or even serial killer films. It just felt very much like revenge flick. Men are awful and all men are prone to becoming evil monsters, and women are also prone to having the 2 lines at most and then being savagely eviscerated. So it's fine. It's good. I feel like I'm like breaking Jacob's heart a little bit because...
No, you're not wrong. I do think that it's definitely... By the time the 5th serial killer shows up, you realize I Saw Devil is a fantasy movie. This weird gonzo fantasia of South Korean violence and revenge. And you're not incorrect about where Kim Ji-woon's focus is and is not. But this is one of my favorite movies because it is just such a gonzo trip. It is the revengiest revenge movie of all time. There's revenge within revenge within revenge. And I Saw the Devil. It goes to such dark, depraved places. And I was prepared to fall down that pit with it.
Yes, it definitely is that. I can't say it's as much my cup of tea, just because by the time the like 3rd or 4th big chase / evisceration scene comes around, I'm like, all right, I get the point. But it's definitely worth a watch if you are looking for the revengiest of revenge films, and it's streaming now on Amazon Video.
Okay, let's move on to what we've been eating. Brad, what have you been eating this week?
Just one new thing, joining the Fruity Pebbles candy bar that I talked about a while back. There is now a Cocoa Pebbles candy bar. This one isn't quite as impressive simply because the combination of white chocolate with Fruity Pebbles gave such a fantastic flavor that it was going to be hard to top. This one is it's a decent enough chocolate bar. I don't think the chocolate is quite as good as it could be, but I like having cocoa pebbles inside of a chocolate bar. It's not quite as I guess tough as some other candy bars that have like crispy rice in them. The one that I talked about not too long ago, the Hoosie What's It. And there's another one that has like rice pieces in it that's like, it's a little bit tougher, and I think it's because there's peanut butter, and I can't remember what it is right now. But it's a thin candy bar, and it's just cocoa pebbles sprinkled throughout, and so it's got a good crunch to it. But I just wish the chocolate itself was a little bit higher quality to make the overall candy bar better. But it's okay.
Brad, I do need to ask a cereal and food connoisseur like yourself, what is the best chocolate cereal? Is it Cocoa Pebbles? Is it Cocoa Puffs? Is it there's like chocolate Frosted Flakes? There's Oreo cereal. There's a bunch, right?
Yeah, if we're talking just strictly chocolate cereal, I think it's Cocoa Puffs, hands down.
Yeah, that was my favorite as a kid. I used to love putting milk in it. I didn't like eating cereal with milk as a kid, but I liked it with Cocoa Puffs because it would turn the milk into chocolate milk.
Yeah, and unlike a lot of other chocolate cereals, the chocolate milk that you get from Cocoa Puffs is usually pretty dang good. So that's why I think it's Cocoa Puffs. And then on a side note, I think Reese's Peanut Butter Puffs also is pretty solid with the mixture of peanut butter and chocolate. So
there you go. I haven't tried that yet.
You've never had Reese's Peanut Butter Puffs?
No.
It's been around forever. How have you not, Peter? It's like best cereals ever made.
Yeah, it's the best. It's the best sugary cereal ever made, Peter. This is a mistake you need to rectify.
I just love that, like, at some point in the 70s or 80s, we thought it was a good idea to eat chocolate for breakfast. I don't know. It just doesn't seem like you could launch that today. Like, now it's accepted. You know, cereal and chocolate cereal is an accepted form of breakfast. But I feel like if you tried to launch that today, the health food fanatics would be like,
I mean, donuts are still, you know, a staple too. Yeah. And, so.
What about Nutella, Peter? I mean, sorry, I'm not like a huge fan of even sweet at breakfast, but I love me some Nutella.
Yeah, I like Nutella.
Okay.
I have nothing right. Hey, I'm not criticizing. I love Cocoa Puffs. I'm just saying it. I don't know. I feel like I'm surprised, you know, when everybody took the pitchforks to the supersize meal at McDonald's, that the chocolate cereals didn't get like wasted on the landscape of cereals. But whatever. Okay, let's move on to what we've been playing. Jacob, what have you been playing?
I've been playing the new PlayStation 5 game Returnal. It's a big release. It's the first PS5 game in a number of months since the console launch, so it's been a lot of people playing older games in their PlayStation 5s waiting for something new to come, and this is the big new Sony exclusive release. And Returnal is a time loop game where you play as an astronaut, a space explorer in the future, who crash lands on an alien planet and starts exploring it, and you die horribly about 10 minutes into the game. Then you reset, your ship crashes again, and you start over again. Each time you retain some of what you got in the first run, but you lose most of it. It's a game design called a roguelike, where you do a series of runs. You try to get as far as you can into the game until you die, then you start over again. And that means, like, if you're really amazingly good at it, you can probably beat it in, like, 2 hours. But otherwise, most of the game is you live, dying, repeating as your character retains memories and some experience and some weapons, but otherwise, things reset to zero every time you try. So it's a game about getting good, about going through this alien planet, which resets every time you play, so it gets randomly regenerated, and trying to get a great run, trying to find the right equipment, find the right path, find the right upgrades that will either be temporary or permanent. And it's really beautiful. It is an incredible looking game. Looks a lot like Prometheus. If Prometheus was an action game, it would look like this. And it's very challenging. It's not holding your hand, but in a way that I found really fun, and the kind of game that encourages you to, really engage with it, try to learn what you're doing. It like I said, I'll go back to Edge of Tomorrow again. It very much is in that same style of, okay, you died, but what did you learn? Okay, you this time I learned, oh, don't go left, you should go right here. Or I learned this gun does this, well, this gun does that. I learned that I should definitely skip this part if I see it. I'm not ready for it. And there have been a lot of roguelike games, you know, made by indie developers where they're much smaller experiences. But this is the first time that I can recall where a run-based game like this was a massively expensive PlayStation 5 game that looked this gorgeous and had this much storytelling going on. And, you know, this is not a game for everybody. If you don't like the idea of spending 2 hours in a video game and dying and then having to reset back to the beginning, this is not for you. But if you can appreciate the experience of what that kind of style of game is and understand that losing, learning, and repeating is the appeal, Returnal is very much the next generation game. It feels like that concept taken to what a PlayStation 5 can do. I mean, also just a side note on the controller. There's been a lot written about the PlayStation 5 controller, which is amazing. It just feels different the way it's a thing called haptic feedback, where it just gives you sensations that you don't feel from previous controllers. Like, for example, in Returnal, you're firing a machine gun at an alien, and you hold down the one of the trigger buttons to fire it. In a lot of other video games, you'll have a secondary fire option. Like, you know, you fire your machine gun this way, then you hit a button to switch firing modes and fire in a different way. Whereas in Returnal, the controller has mechanisms in it so that when you hold down the trigger, you'll fire normally, but it only lets you hold down the trigger halfway. Like, literally, the controller offers a brick wall of resistance, so you can only hold it down halfway. But then if you push through the resistance by putting just a little bit of effort, you overpower it, essentially, and switch to your different firing modes. So instead of having to push a button to switch firing modes, you got to apply pressure on triggers in different ways, which ends up feeling amazing. Like, I've never played a game that felt like this. And the way that it uses the controller technology, the haptic feedback, to have the physical sensation of pushing buttons in different ways be a vital part of playing the game is absolutely incredible. So, like I said, I would definitely watch some videos about Returnal and read some reviews and make sure it's for you. But if you like challenging science fiction games, and if you know what the phrase roguelike even means, this is definitely a video game you should be checking out if you're fortunate enough to have a PlayStation 5 right now.
I love how we've come full circle, Jacob. And, you know, when I used to play video games, you know, when it was arcades or NES or Atari, like, there were no save points in the beginning. And that was like a criticism, but now, like, that's the concept.
Yeah, it's like I said, some people really want that safety net. I totally get it. I mean, there's been some criticism online about Returnal about how it doesn't have an autosave feature, so if your system crashes mid-run, you're shit out of luck, and I get that. I hope they're working on a fix to prevent that from happening to people. It hasn't happened to me yet, but at the same time, though, there's something to be said about getting on a great run, getting all the best weapons, getting all the best upgrades, and getting deep and deep and deep into the game, and then dying and waking back up at the beginning of the time loop without all of your equipment, but also realizing that, oh, one of the upgrades I did get was permanent. So even though I died, this one little thing is still with me forever now. And it's a really good feeling, one that I treasure a lot in games like this.
Okay, we've reached the end of today's Slash Film Daily. You can find more of all of our work at slashfilm.com. You can find this podcast on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please feel free to send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns to us at peter@slashfilm.com. And please head on over to our Apple's podcast page. Write us a sentence of why you like this podcast. Give us 5 stars. It really helps us quite a bit. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Hey, Peter, you weren't here last week for the gargantuan book of insult, offense, and effrontery. Sharp retorts, riposte, caustic quips, imply put downs by Louis A. Safian.
I dodged a bullet.
Yeah, well, no, it means you get triple the insults today, Peter.
Wait, that doesn't add up. It should be like double.
Peter, I gotta punish you, like, to make sure it doesn't happen again. Okay, I vote to page 146, old fogies. Chris, he considers, sorry, not Chris, this is Peter. I'll get to Chris in a second. Peter. Peter considers a 10 p.m. TV program the Late Late Show.
I mean, that is, wait, what?
Peter considers a 10 p.m. TV program the Late Late Show.
Wait, Brad, when does the Late Late Show
The Late Late Show is usually on at
11:30. Oh, so it's not that far off, Jacob.
Peter considers a 10 p.m. TV program the Late Late Show. Peter, he's chock full of pep for an hour or two a day.
Because you're honestly old.
Wow. I can relate to a lot of these.
Yeah.
Peter, he's done long before the day is.
Yeah.
Okay, Peter goes three. Chris, it's taking Chris longer to rest than to get tired.
Oh.
Yeah. Ben Pearson, he putters around the garden and mutters around the house.
Love to putter.
HT, the hardest thing for her is to raise in her garden are her knees.
Ah.
Oh.
I like that there were two garden jokes in her.
Well, hope you're ready for a third one, because Brad, the only thing he grows in his garden is tired.
It seems like Louis A. Safian didn't really like gardening.
I think these jokes were, a lot of these jokes were written at a time when there wasn't a TV, so like all people had to do was watch their gardens.
Sounds like a nice life, like, honestly.
I mean, he's like looking out of his window. He's like, where can I set this next joke? A garden. Ah, yes.
There's a real Great Depression era vibe to this page, including when he turns out the light, it's for economy instead of romance because, you know, saving money.
Ah. Wow. Yeah. That's a tinge of sadness to that one.
It's practical. Yeah.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.